Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics for Monday, April 7th, 2014. I'm Mitch Jezerich. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, United Nations body tasked with providing scientific data on global warming, last week released its latest report that puts, for the first time, greater emphasis on how to address an inevitable warmer world. It warned that food shortages, the spread of disease, and conflict would be more frequent in the years ahead. It's a second installment of the three-part report. The final installment is expected later this month. The first one was done in September of last year. The last time the IPCC released such a mammoth report was in 2007, when it won the Nobel Peace Prize along with Al Gore. It is being reported that this time both the quantity and quality of climate models have increased significantly. And joining me to talk about all of this is climate scientist Michael Wehner. Michael Wehner does climate modeling at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, and he is one of the lead authors on the IPCC report chapters on long-term climate change projections and climate models. That came out in September of last year. He's also the lead author of the upcoming third U.S. National Climate Assessment. Michael Wehner, I thank you for being here.
Well, thank you.
Tell me more about what we know now compared to the IPCC's report from 2007.
Well, a lot of what's in this new report was in the previous reports. And in some sense, the message is generally unchanged, although it's stronger. A lot of the statements have been made with higher confidence, but largely they're unchanged. And that's that the conclusion is that human consumption of carbon-based fuels have changed the composition of the atmosphere. That has changed the entire climate system. And we fully expect that those changes will become much larger and more serious as we continue to burn these fuels.
Do we have more data from the modeling?
We do. Models are substantially improved. Climate models are computer programs, just like a video game or a phone app, only somewhat more complicated, considerably, than perhaps the most sophisticated computer games, tries to model all aspects of the climate system. Principally, those are the atmosphere and the ocean and the ice components. That would be both the sea ice in the Arctic and Antarctic, as well as the land ice tied up in the glaciers there. They also model processes on the land, including the biosphere.
Is this a more complicated version of, say, getting the weather forecast?
Actually, there's a lot of similarity between weather models and weather prediction models and climate models. The climate modeling grew out of weather prediction, for sure. Certainly, the modeling did. The differences, though, are mainly that climate is interested in the long-term statistics of the weather, and so the models are subtly different.
Mm-hmm. Is there a reason? How accurate are these models? How much faith can we put in them? And why aren't they 100% accurate? And could they ever be?
Well, it depends on what you want to know.
Yeah.
Right
now we're talking about what's it going to be like with a warmer world.
Right. What can we expect? And so the broad aspects of the climate are very well simulated. There are some notable deficiencies in the simulation of large-scale climate. A lot of models have trouble simulating some aspects of the tropics in the Pacific, which is deemed to be important. But some things, and I think people confuse weather and climate a lot. A lot of things you can't intrinsically model. You cannot model you can't predict what the weather's going to be like 2 months from now. You can predict a little bit about the climate 2 months from now, because it's very much controlled by the El Nino cycles, and those are fairly well predictable on that time scale. You certainly can't predict what's going to happen in 10 years as far as what's going to happen on April, what's today, 7th, in 2024. But we can make statements about what the climate will be like on longer-term time scales, and the climate models do very well at that. Another thing very much intrinsically impossible is to say a lot of details about particular locations. And so that part is improving. Some years ago, we probably would only have confidence at the global scales. I think at this point, we are, subcontinental. We can make fairly confident statements about how the climate in the Western United States will change versus in the Eastern United States. And it is different.
So my understanding is right now, when we talk about a warming world, we are locked into it for at least the next 30 years or so, to about 2040.
If we went to the Stone Age tomorrow, that would be true.
Meaning that we
just stopped. You know, everybody stopped driving their cars. You didn't turn on your lights. You didn't listen to the radio. You stopped consuming fossil fuels. There's the changes we've made to the atmosphere have already locked in a certain amount of climate change. And there's a delay in the response of the climate to these changes that we've done because the ocean is so large and has such a capacity to take up heat and energy.
So what is that? What do we know is going to happen between now and 2040?
Well, I'd be really willing to bet we're not going to stop burning fossil fuels.
Sure.
And so we are locked into probably another degree or more between now and the middle of the century of global warming. We've already had about 0.8 of a degree since the pre-industrial times, and this has had severe and profound impacts on our climate that the IPCC notes. But one of the things you have to understand about the IPCC, and I'm part of that, I love being part of it, I think it's one of the most important things I've done professionally in my career, is it's a naturally conservative body. Scientists, in general, are conservative bunches. They want proof, and your reputation can be ruined if you jump to conclusions without proof.
It's also consensus-based.
And it's a and then it's a consensus of naturally conservative folks. And so both the Working Group 1 and Working Group 2 reports state the obvious, that climate change has occurred and is serious. But there is a general feeling that they don't want to be perceived as alarmist. The climate change deniers accuse the IPCC of being alarmist all the time. I don't believe it is. But what it has to say is indeed alarming, and we should be alarmed. The United Nations Framework on Climate Change Conventions has agreed in Copenhagen a few years ago, this is an intergovernmental body, that climate change should be limited to 2 degrees centigrade above, that's about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, above the pre-industrial levels globally, in order to avoid, quote, dangerous climate change. And I actually have an issue with this. What is dangerous climate change, and who gets to decide what's dangerous and what's not? A two-degree warmer world is substantially different than the world we live in. Storms will be significantly more intense. Sea level will be higher. The risks of damages is greatly increased. But even with the 0.8 of a degree that we've had, I believe that the consequences have been dangerous.
Now.
So the dangerous climate change is here and now. And that's an alarming thing to say.
Now, every time we either get a major hurricane or a major drought and we talk about climate change, we're always quick to add that we can't say that this single event is being caused because of a warming world.
That statement, on the face of it, is indeed true, because it's an absolute statement. But it's not true that we can't say something about how climate change affects the risk of individual events. And I'll give a few examples. Heat waves are an obvious thing that are going to change in a future warmer world. In fact, they have. In 2003, there was a major heat wave in Europe, often called the Paris heat wave, because many, many people died. It's been estimated that 70,000 people died prematurely from that heat wave in 2003. Now, analysis by a number of groups, including our own, have determined that the risk of this event was doubled by climate change. It's not that this event couldn't have happened in pre-industrial
but the chances of it happening
has doubled.
The
chances of it happened have doubled. and it's sort of like loading the dice. This also happened in 2010 in Russia. There was a heat wave that was very persistent over central Russia, Moscow. There were fires that were a result of this drought and heat wave, and the air quality was very bad, and 50,000 people died prematurely. That one was also doubled.
And there are many. Talk to me about those deaths, though. It's not that it was just hot and everyone died because of the heat, but there are related elements.
Yeah, most of those people were elderly.
Yeah.
And you know, they in the Paris heat wave, a lot of people go on vacation in August. It was in August, and they left the elderly people stayed back, and that was the consequence. So there are behavioral changes.
There's air quality. There's heat stroke. There are a number of different.
There are a number of things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are examples of serious consequences of climate change in industrialized countries, and usually it's said that climate change will affect the poor, and indeed it does, but I would argue these people weren't poor; they were just like you and me, climate change affects everyone.
What about the agriculture that was in this latest report? And again, recognizing you worked on the previous report put out in September, this one talked a lot about agriculture and scarcity of food in the future.
Yeah, I have a research interest in agriculture and climate change through the College of Natural Resources here at the University of California, Berkeley. And I find it really interesting that the Working Group 2 highlighted this early on in the summary for policymakers, which is one of the documents I recommend that listeners look up. It's reasonably accessible to the non-scientist. It's written for that audience. And it highlights that that food supplies are at risk because of climate change. A lot of that comes about because of drought. I wrote a paper not too long ago looking at a measure of drought in the United States and Mexico the end of this century, about 2.5 degrees warmer in this scenario I looked at. And essentially the entire nation would be in a condition today called severe drought. Most of the West would be in extreme drought, and Mexico is pretty much off the charts. And this happened.
Off the charts for a drought.
For drought, yeah. Yeah, unprecedented droughts that have not been seen historically. And that would be the normal state.
How far off into the future would this be?
Well, that was basically a 2.5 degree world, which somewhere in the latter half of this century. This is a very frightening projection, probably the most frightening one I've made. Why would we believe this? The reason for that is the reason that I have some confidence in this rather alarming projection is that we understand some of the physics behind it. As it gets hotter, things evaporate more readily, and so the soil will dry out. And that was at this measure of agricultural drought, they call that, is designed to measure.
You found this through modeling.
Through modeling, yes. And so it's a projection. You know, that's the only way we can make statements about the – well, there's two ways we can make statements about the future. One is through modeling. But if that was the only thing we used, I wouldn't have a lot of faith in it. One has to understand the details of the processes that are causing these changes. And in this case, it's really quite straightforward that evaporation increases rather dramatically as it gets warmer.
Again, we are in conversation with Michael Wehner, climate scientist at Berkeley Labs Computational Research Division. He was one of the authors on the first of three reports from the IPCC that was released in September. Is the drought that we're experiencing now in California related to the research that you have done about droughts in the future?
That's a really great question and a difficult one. This drought has been characterized by a deficit in precipitation. And there are suggestions that the rain that we normally would get in California could move towards the north. It's hard to say at this time whether that has happened in any appreciable way. This is a subject of debate within our own community about how much effect climate change has had on precipitation patterns at the time. And I'm not going to say that it has a significant effect. It may have had some effect. I think more interesting to California, though, something we can say for sure, is that California's water supply depends on the Sierra snowpack. And the timing of the snow melt is critical to the infrastructure in California. The dams and canals and aqueducts were all built assuming the climate at the time they were built. As the temperatures get warmer, even if precipitation doesn't change, and we have an average year, we still experience water shortages. And that's because the snowpack melts earlier and it flows through the system faster. The water resource
management. The infrastructure may not be there to...
That's right. Water resource managers will have to let the water through. And so even if you have the same amount of water, the timing is critical. And so late in the season, before the rains start again, we'll run out of water. And there's a number of papers that are very well done, written by Tim Barnett and Dave Pierce at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in San Diego, projecting rather dire consequences for the major reservoirs in the West before the middle of the century.
We've seen the difficulty of reducing greenhouse emissions and trying to address this issue. If we stay on this course, and perhaps you're more optimistic than I, but I haven't seen anything that would suggest that we're about to make some type of dramatic change. What does the modeling say for, say, 100, 200 years from now?
Well, that's a good question, too. The IPCC considered four different scenarios of the future. The first one is a very dramatic geoengineering greenhouse gas reduction, where you invent some technology to extract carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Those technologies exist, but not at scale. That would limit climate change to under 2 degrees centigrade. I don't think anybody believes that.
Do we have the technology to do that?
No. And so I don't think leave anybody.
Do we have an idea of how to do that?
There are ideas. I'm not certainly not expert on it. One would have to extract billions of tons of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere every year in order to have this happen. And that negative emissions, as it were, would have to start occurring in 10 years or so. We considered also what I like to call the no policy scenario, where greenhouse gas emissions increase at some historical rate, and then some intermediate scenarios between the rather drastic reductions.
And that's what I'm trying to get at. I guess the no policy scenario. Yeah, what does that look like?
Well, what I want to say is that was the worst case scenario that we considered. It's not the worst case.
It's not the worst case scenario.
It's not the worst
just
case
one
scenario.
You considered. What's the difference between one you considered and the worst case scenario?
Well, the interesting difference is what has happened and what is the worst case scenario. The emissions have actually exceeded the worst case scenario because of the timing of the IPCC report. Things have to be set several years in advance. Mm-hmm. It takes several years to write the report, to do the calculations. By that time, you know, your projections actually are of the last part of the last part of the actual historical record. And we've exceeded the emission rates
in
the worst case scenario that we considered.
Right.
And so what I'll tell you is that by the end of the century, one would expect about 4 degrees centigrade change from pre-industrial times, and that would continue on into the following century.
What would that mean?
It means it's going to be a lot different planet than it is now. It'd be hotter.
Uh-huh.
Well, it has there are all sorts of implications. One of which I would say is this is essentially permanent. That climate the climate would stay that much warmer for 1,000 years or more, probably more.
Is that also because we're also going naturally towards warmer period?
No. This is solely just due to the human. The human changes to the atmosphere. It takes that long for the Earth system to absorb that much carbon dioxide, and so and it will be absorbed in the oceans eventually, and you know eventually it becomes volcanic and becomes rock again. But those timescales are geologic and very long.
In previous warm periods in which life existed, perhaps when humans existed, how much warmer were previous warm periods than now?
Well, this is today is the warmest it's been in 100,000 years. So, you know, in human times, this is the warmest it's ever been.
In human times, this is the warmest.
Yes. Now, you go back to, you know, very long prehistoric times, millions of years ago, there were periods that were quite a bit warmer. Planet was a lot different. You know, they find fossil records of dinosaurs that lived above what was the Arctic Circle at the time because the planet was very much warmer. There was no ice. It's a very different planet. And it's not one that we really know a lot about. I mean, you know, we know a little bit about this from fossil records, but we don't know anything really about what the weather is like.
Right.
One of our interests, you mentioned that I'm in the computational research division. One of our interests is simulating the statistics of hurricanes and tropical storms. There's an emerging consensus that that the strongest storms will be substantially stronger, and so the likelihood of Cat 5 storms hitting the United States or the Philippines or Taiwan and China in the Pacific will be increased.
My understanding is that we can expect these hurricanes to be more severe, but actually have less hurricanes altogether.
We will have less weaker ones. That's the consensus.
Uh-huh.
I'm inclined to subscribe to that consensus after studying this for the last couple of years. The garden variety hurricanes will become fairly, you know, reduced by, you know, maybe 10%. You know, that number is actually, you know, quite debated. But let's, for point of argument, just say about that number. But the strongest storms will become more frequent, and the very strongest storms will be substantially stronger. And again, you know, why would I believe this alarming projection? And there's some understanding behind this, and one of which is that when you have a Category 4, Category 5 hurricane, the conditions for hurricane formation are about perfect. And one of the controlling factors is the amount of energy available. In a warmer world, there's more energy available.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do expect that from time to time these rather ideal conditions for hurricane formation will happen. We don't project that that's going to change. And so when it does, there's more energy available.
And again, just to really emphasize here, we keep talking about dangerous conditions in the future. You're saying they're here now.
Well, yes, for some aspects of the climate. Whether or not the statistics of hurricanes have changed yet is another hotly debated subject within the community. And it's a difficult problem because the observational record of hurricanes is relatively short. It goes back 100 years, but prior to the satellite era, our knowledge is somewhat incomplete. And prior to the Second World War, it's very incomplete.
Are all the effects negative of a warming world?
That's an interesting question. Depends on your values. The IPCC Working Group 2, which is sort of new in this report, is it talks more about the risks of climate change rather than climate change is going to cause such and such a thing. It says the risk of this is changing. And so come to California, let's say the risk of wine production in Napa and Sonoma being detrimental is such and such, but that potentially can creates an opportunity for somebody else.
Mm-hmm. And more so, inland.
Perhaps farther north. Uh-huh. If it got too hot in Napa. And so there's a value judgment. I'm not necessarily willing to make this value judgment, but certainly, one person's misfortune can create another person's opportunity.
But it sounds like, at least according to the poor, there's going to be a lot more misfortune.
And society in general is affected pretty poorly on this. Food shortages, as we mentioned, are highlighted in this report, and that affects all of us. Disproportionately the poor, of course.
The New York Times reported that as part of the larger report that's included is that there needs to be an aid for poorer countries, about $100 billion. But that in the negotiations of the 48-page executive summary that world leaders read, they actually took that part out.
Yeah, I can't really speak to that, but I would comment that IPCC is charged with being policy relevant, but not policy prescriptive. And so I would not be surprised if that was not there for those reasons, because it doesn't. The IPCC is a body of scientists, and it doesn't pretend to want to be able to dictate what policy are implemented to deal with climate change. That is actually the responsibility of the people through their elected officials, not the scientists. Our responsibility is to inform the public and policymakers of what we know and what the implications of what we know are, and it is up to the people of the planet to decide what to do.
Michael Wehner, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Again, Michael Wehner has been our guest. He's a climate scientist, and he does climate modeling at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. He was one of the lead authors on the IPCC report's chapters on long-term climate change projections and climate models. And you're also the lead author on the upcoming third U.S. National Climate Assessment. When will that be coming out?
Oh, that is coming up shortly. And I would refer listeners to the website www.globalchange.gov for more information about that.
Michael Wehner, thank you again.
Thank you.
When we come back,